Thanks for having me. And you might have seen already my daughter dancing in the aisle there. But I'm here with my family. Molly is my wife. My daughter Ginny is currently slumped in her lap. And we actually have another daughter on the way in May 15th. So we are excited for that. Absolutely. And we've lived here for about 6 years. I'm from Pittsburgh. Molly is from Atlanta, and both of our kids are from Boston, so we're like excited to be like, yeah, so we have like, we're here now. We like live here now. And I live in Somerville. I work for Sojourn Collegiate Ministry. I'm a college minister mostly for students at Tufts University and Lesley Universities down in Somerville. And we have a mission statement, which you might find familiar, helping students find their way back to God. Exactly. If it's good, use it. So anyway, yeah, and I'm going to talk about unity and forgiveness, and I want to start with a story. So when I was in high school, I had to read a book. I was assigned a book. It was Murder on the Orient Express, if you've ever heard of that book. It's Agatha Christie. It's a classic murder mystery. It's a whodunit, and if you don't like to read, it's a movie. I think a movie came out 3 years ago. It's a great book. It's a classic sort of misdirection. You don't know what's going to happen all the way to the end. Don't worry, I'm not going to ruin it for you. But one day in high school, I was reading this book, and it was required reading at my high school. I have an older brother. He had read it about 2 years earlier, and I'm reading it. I'm sitting on the couch, and he comes in, and he's like, oh, you're reading Murder on the Orient Express. Do you know what's happening? Do you know that there's like, who do you think did it? Who do you think committed the murder? You know? And he's doing that annoying thing that people do when they want to not spoil something, but spoil something. And anyway, so I'm saying, you know what, Tyler, I don't care anymore. I will just flip to the end. I'm going to read the last three pages, and then I'll be done with it, okay? And he goes, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. He runs in. He grabs the book out of my hand, runs into the kitchen, opens a drawer, takes out some scotch tape, and tapes the last three pages of the book together. And this is like the school gave me this book. So I'm going to get yelled at whenever Mrs. Mueller like finds out that this book is ruined. So he tapes the last three pages. He goes, you can't read the last three pages. Because if you do, all of the tension, all of the buildup, all of the misdirection, it's going to go away. Okay? If you change, it'll change kind of the whole middle part. There's really almost no point in reading it if you know what happens at the end. And so I want to tell that story because I think it has a lot to do with what I want to talk about, what I've kind of been obsessing about. When Pastor Katie asked me to talk today, I have been just absolutely kicking around this idea of unity, how it kind of intersects with forgiveness. I'm a student also myself. I'm working on my MDiv at Harvard Divinity School. I'm about halfway through. At times I get to write papers and I get to do a little bit of kind of sermon experimentation, but I never really get to preach anything. And so this is actually, in a lot of cases, a way to kind of solidify my thoughts about how these things come together. And it's really not that, you know, surprising to say that we live in a world of disunity. We all kind of emerged from the pandemic in the last couple of years, and we've seen this world, and it looks like things are a lot more just distant than usual. As you come back, you're starting to see, oh my gosh, it's people are on this side or on this side. Every time I'm back in a space like this and I get into a conversation, I'm kind of cynical. I'll start talking to somebody that I haven't talked to in 2 years, and I'm sort of waiting for them to say something that's like nuts. You know, I don't know if you've had this exact same experience, but you're waiting for them to sort of say something that you're like, okay, that's where you stand on the extreme of this or that. And it's so frustrating because that's like a really hard way to see the world as sort of this cautiously like moving about and seeing like, all right, what does this person think? And I don't want to linger on the things that divide us. This is not going to be let's all get on the same page about what divides us. That's not what this is about. What this is about is really what we're going through as ourselves, as individuals, and as we come back to church, what we're going through as a church. All right, I'm a minister. I've been going to church my entire life. My wife's the same. We have been seriously evaluating our relationship to the church as we've come back from the pandemic. We've sat there at the kitchen table and we said, why do we even go? You know, who are those? Are they even doing the things that we want to do? Do we trust the staff? Do we trust the money that we're giving to this church? Like, why? Why are we doing this, right? And that, yeah, we're on board with Jesus. We're on board with Christianity in general. But like, this group, who are they? And what are we all doing? And can we ever agree? And this person thinks this, and this person thinks that. And it's hard. That's a hard place to be as a church, because church is the place that we should understand one another. It's the place where on a constant basis we're talking about things like forgiveness. We're trying to sort of reconcile our differences. The church should be that place that we have unity. And I talk about the church because when we talk about forgiveness, it kind of gets a little bit confusing. It kind of gets overly simplistic. I'm going to throw a couple of Bible verses on the screen that you might have seen before. They talk about forgiveness. They talk about kind of compassion. The first one's from Ephesians. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving one another, just as Christ forgave you. A second one from Colossians. Bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive, you know, as the Lord forgave you. The last one from 1 John. You know, confess our sins. He's faithful to forgive us and to choose from all and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. These are things that we've heard. These are things that maybe, like me, your mom has written on like a poster and put them in the kitchen. There's things that, yeah, when it comes to forgiveness, we hear this stuff. Forgiveness is a word that comes up, depending on your translation of the Bible, like 100 times. You know, so we're used to hearing about, oh, I need to do this. I need to forgive people. And we can't talk about forgiveness without the ultimate line from the Sermon on the Mount. It's this one. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek. Also, Sermon on the Mount. You have to listen to that one because it was Jesus that said that one. Turn the other cheek. We've all heard this. I work with students that are reading the Bible for the first time. And they know this, turn the other cheek. If someone, you know, punches you in the face, let them turn your head and let them punch you in the face again. That's ridiculous, right? That's a ridiculous thing. And as a minister, I have to sit there and be like, well, it's in the Bible. We have to do it. And the thing about forgiveness is that it's just so difficult. I've been doing this my whole life. Like I said, I've been growing up in the church my entire life. And it's something I haven't ever been able to do well. Okay, it's something that I can talk about from a distance, that from a pulpit, I'll say, hey, forgive one another, you know, figure it out. Other people's problems look really easy from this perspective. But when it comes to me, when I'm arguing with my brother, my family, it is very difficult to kind of come together and to say, oh yeah, I'll just forgive you. I'll just turn the other cheek. That's what I'll do. And not only is it hard, it also kind of sets this ridiculous precedent for the injured party. Right, a lot of these phrases and a lot of these Bible verses have been used to perpetuate oppression because they are things where it seems like if you're the hurt party, the thing that you have to do is to come to the person who's hurt you and ask for forgiveness, which is like a real upside-down way of thinking about stuff, right? You are the one that has been hurt, and yet you are the one that has to go and sort of say, hey, I'm sorry, let's come back together again. And so that creates a situation where, yeah, the person who is oppressing somebody, the person who's hurting somebody, doesn't have to do anything. They just get to sit there and they get to say, well, you know, you have to come to me. And again, that makes it really, really difficult to talk about this stuff, especially in church settings, because we know that the ideal is this forgiving world, but we know that that's not something that really exists on the ground or something that really feels right within us. And so, like I said, I've been obsessed with this, and I'm kind of scanning the Bible for ways to understand forgiveness and ways to understand really unity, how to come back together again, ways to understand those things that, I guess, make sense to me, that make sense to the situation that I live in that I'm coming to right now. And so I found something interesting. It's in Luke chapter 7. I'm going to read kind of a little bit of this. You might have heard this before. It's I wouldn't say that it's like, you know, Good Samaritan level of Bible, but it's definitely, it may be second tier. But this is Luke chapter 7, verses 36 through 39. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, so she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. All right, so we're going to stop right there. That she is a sinner. So what I present to you is a scene of disunity. A scene of disunity. First off, we have the woman who's been accused of being a sinner. And it says that she's living a sinful life. It's very difficult to kind of understand what that means, but I can tell you this. You've probably heard this a few times. Options for women in that time, extremely limited. Okay, best case scenario, you got married. You started having children almost immediately. Your husband was wealthy enough to support you throughout your entire life. You know, the kids that you had, hopefully they were men, and that those kids were thriving, and then you didn't do anything to sort of offend your husband or the position that he's in. If any of that stuff goes wrong, as the woman, you're out on the street, okay? Your husband could divorce you for any reason, and all of a sudden, you are in a world where you have extremely limited agency. Okay, for the woman, it doesn't say necessarily that she's a prostitute, but if that was the life that she turned to, really, that was almost the only option that she could have had to make money. And the society that she lives in order to be sort of called not sinful, she would have had to go to the temple, she would have had to make some sacrifices, she would have pay for those sacrifices, and if she doesn't have any money, she couldn't do that, so she remains in this sinful state, because essentially there are all these forces conspiring to keep her there. Okay, so whether or not she has agency in some of the choices she is making, or she is just completely sort of bereft of that agency, she's in a really, really tough spot. Really, really tough spot. And this is a conversation that I think that as a country we're having right now, okay, to understand that there are forces that we understand and that we don't understand that are conspiring to hold certain groups in positions, right? That is something that sort of we know. We know to have compassion on this person when we read this story. Because that's what we see Jesus do. So we know this part. The part that I think is actually really interesting to look at is the Pharisees' position. So the Pharisees, all right, we know that they're the bad guys. I went to Sunday school growing up. The Pharisees were always the ones that were kind of like in the peanut gallery to anything that Jesus did. He's performing a miracle over there, and they're the ones like snickering, like, you can't do that, it's the Sabbath. So there's such a like, I don't know, one-dimensional sort of evilness to the Pharisees that I really want to add a little nuance to, because I think it actually speaks to a lot of the things that we're facing right now in our country. So Pharisees, if you were going to be a Pharisee, it meant that was your job. It meant at a young age, you showed a lot of promise academically. You probably memorized large parts of the Torah, which is the first five books of what we call the Old Testament. It meant that you continued to study. It continued to provide commentary to those laws. And society lifted you up to these positions of power. It became your job to sort of judge people, to say, this is a sin, this is not a sin. So when Simon says, this woman is a sinner, he is doing his job, right? Good or bad, I'm certainly saying that this is not a good job that he's doing, but that's his job. His identity and his purpose are wrapped up in the thing that he is doing right there, okay? And that's a really, really hard place to be. Right? Because, again, we gain a lot of purpose, I derive a lot of joy, a lot of purpose from the job that I do, okay? And you can't just go to somebody whose job, whose purpose, everything that they've been studying for their entire life and say, hey, don't do that, or you're doing this wrong. You can't just speak sort of truth to that power, because that power structure can create its own truth, right? For these Pharisees, a feedback loop was created. Every time that they rule on this is a sin, this is not a sin, and society sort of continues on, it tells them, hey, I'm doing the right thing, okay? God hasn't really, you know, taken revenge on all of us. So for hundreds of years, these Pharisees have been in positions of power, and things have been going okay. And so when you're in a position of power, all of that feedback, all of that knowledge then feeds back on itself, and it means that your truth sort of lives outside of whatever truth is happening. And that is a conversation that we're having as well, right? How power creates these systems where we understand ourselves to be right or understand ourselves to be wrong, okay? So yeah, you have the woman, you have the Pharisees, it's a complex scene, but it's a complex scene because you've got somebody who's oppressed, who the system is holding down, and you've got somebody who is really a beneficiary of that system, right? Whose purpose is derived from that system. And you've got Jesus. So we'll go right here into talk about what Jesus does really quick. Okay, Jesus tells a story. That's what he does. If you ever want to guess what Jesus is about to do, perform a miracle, tell a story. Jesus tells a story. Simon just calls this woman a sinner, and then Jesus picks it up at verse 41. He goes, two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii, and the other 50. Neither of them had any money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now, which one of them will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. Jesus says, bingo. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and she wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little. Then Jesus said to her, looks right at the woman, he says, your sins are forgiven. The other guests began to say amongst themselves, who is this even that forgives sins? Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Go in peace. The interesting thing is that Jesus put the spotlight on the woman, right? And it's even interesting to kind of read this and to hear that there's kind of some talk over here about the people in the room, but Jesus keeps the spotlight on the woman. And as we read these stories, it's easy to kind of put yourself in the shoes of, who am I? Well, maybe I'm the woman. Maybe I'm the one who needs to seek Jesus' forgiveness, that kind of thing. But I read this, it's more often than not on the Pharisees, okay? I grew up in the suburbs, got a good family, I'm a man, I'm white, I have a great education. I more often than not have been asked to sort of weigh on people's situations, to judge people's situations, especially in ministry. As a college minister, college kids come to me and they say, you know, what are we supposed to do? We talk about it, that kind of thing. I find myself in this position where, yeah, I'm part of a structure of power that is reinforcing my knowledge about who I think I am. You know, these Pharisees, they're wrong, okay? But a really hard thing is to hear that wrongness and then to reevaluate life in light of that. It's easy from afar to say they're doing something wrong, but it's really hard to look inside myself and to say, what am I missing? And this is a complex situation. This is a complex situation because, yeah, clearly this woman has been done wrong by society, but the people in positions of power feel like they're doing the right thing. And what happens? Jesus tells a story. He tells a story about these two guys who owed this money lender a debt. He forgives them both. And it seems like the simplistic reading is similar to some of the other readings of forgiveness that we saw earlier. That the simplistic reasoning is, yeah, if you have a little bit of debt, maybe it gets forgiven, and then you're fine. You feel okay, but you don't feel great. If you've forgiven a lot of debt, then of course you're going to feel, you know, really wonderful when that debt is forgiven. But this is not a story about the magnitude of grace. This is not the story about the magnitude of grace. Jesus is doing something a lot bigger here. What he's doing, and this is why I told that story at the beginning, what he is doing is he's putting the attention on the woman, and he is saying, this is the last three pages of the book, okay? This is the last three pages of the book. There is going to be a time when we understand, whether it's in this life or after, where we understand how much we need God. And at that moment, when the abyss just opens up within you, when you can't stand it anymore, and you go to God and you say, God, oh my God, I need forgiven. Peace will be granted to you at that exact moment. So you have these two forces conspiring. What does Jesus not do? He doesn't point out all of the things that are sort of going on in this room. He says, this woman gets it. This woman gets it. We have infinite capacity to hurt one another. Okay? As humans, that's kind of the stakes of free will, is that we have infinite capacity to create these structures that oppress one another, knowingly and unknowingly, that put people in certain positions, that rob them of their agency. Okay? We do that. We do that at church. Oh my gosh, we do it at church. And if you've been coming to church for a while, you know that. And it breaks my heart as a minister. It breaks all of our hearts. And how do we get together again? Well, we got to know the last three pages of the book, right? We got to know where we're all going to end up. This is kind of Christianity 101, is that point where are we going to be? We're going to be at the feet of Jesus, okay? And that image, that the woman who's crying, who Jesus is sitting there, she's crying so much that it's enough to wet his feet adequately so that she can come in with her hair and wipe off his feet. And then she grabs this jar of perfume, which we can guess, might be one of the most valuable things that she owns. Pours that on his feet, anoints his feet, which is a term that just means to put oil on something, but it has these really significant religious undertones. And then she kisses his feet, which harkens back to images that we see in the Psalm of Psalms. You know, her act is this absolute just throughout history in the context of what you know you would understand in terms of Jewish law. This is a significant act. And Jesus is looking at the Pharisees and saying, "This is it." Okay? After all of these things that we've built, after all of these structures, these things that we've unintentionally and intentionally done to one another, we're going to get to this point where we just realize we need God. And that's the point where we're going to be granted forgiveness. That's the point where we're going to be granted peace. So that's the end. It's the last three pages. And so when we think about unity, we've got to think about those last three pages. But what do we do now? Okay, I still have beefs in my life that I'm trying to resolve. Okay, we still have churches that we need to rebuild from the pandemic. We still have people that in our lives that have hurt us, that we have hurt, structures that we're all still a part of. So what do we do? All right, we know that Jesus is waiting at the end. We know that. Okay, but what do we do right now? One time I was at a Sox game. I'm leaving the stadium. And I'm trying to get home to Copley Square to take the T back to Somerville. I get out of the game. I'm on Lansdowne Street. If you've been down there, I'm on Lansdowne Street. I'm taking a right, and I'm trying to get over the bridge, over the highway. I think they named that after David Ortiz, the David Ortiz Bridge. I'm trying to get over there because Copley Square is on the other side. That's where the T stop is. All right, so I'm walking with a buddy of mine. We take that right, and all of a sudden it's like there's just like this wall, okay? They have all these like street blockers there. There's a couple cops. And it's not just the street, it's a sidewalk too. And it's blocked off. And it's like kind of all of us are like ants. We're like just coming up against this wall. And I'm like a really nice person. I go up to the cop and I go, "What the heck? I'm trying to get over there." And he looks at me and he says the greatest line, I think, in English that you can say to somebody, which is, "You can't get there from here. You can't get there from here." And I love that. I love that phrase so much. "You can't get there from here." And me, I go, because I'm really nice, I go, "What do you mean you can't get there from here? I'm looking over there. There's people over there. If you're telling me that for the rest of time, the rest of human history, that people over here and people over there are never going to see each other, then yes, I can get over there from now." He doesn't say anything because he's used to taking stuff like this. But it's one of those things where, yeah, maybe I got to go around. Maybe I got to wait. Okay? But "you can't get there from here" is such a phrase that sort of like, I don't know, just belays this point. And I'm from Pittsburgh. We also have a heritage of ridiculous traffic. And "you can't get there from here" is something that, oh my gosh, I've heard so many times. Right? Because it's sort of, you know, I mean, it's a lie. Right? We've been to the moon. We can get there. Okay? But the thing is what makes it crazy is the fact that, yeah, you can look over and you can see that people are there. Right? And that's what the last three pages are. It's sort of reconciling this difference between we have this barrier from where we are now and where we want to get to. All right, and the good news is that for the last 1,800 years, we've been trying to figure out that. That's the life of faith. That's the life of the Christian, okay? Is to figure out how we get to that end while resolving all of the barriers that we have in the middle here. And so the nice thing is there's a lot of wisdom. A lot of stuff that comes up that I have been learning in school. And one of my favorite people that I've been learning about is this guy, John Cassian. Okay, I think I have a picture of him. There he is. I love John Cassian, not because of the things that he says, but because his name is John Cassian. All the rest of these guys have weird names, like Origen or like Dionysius. And his name is John Cassian, which sounds like he could be on the second line of the Bruins. Okay, and it's like, there's John Cassian. 3 assists yesterday. And so it's really great to hear somebody from like the 4th and 5th century that sounds like, you know, he just is living right now. But John Cassian, he was a monk. And really, as the monk, your job was to digest all of the information in the Bible, all of the sort of commentaries, all of that stuff, and then be like the repository of information for your community. All right, so people came to monks and they said, "Hey, I don't know how to read and write, but you do. Can you give me some wisdom? And Cassian wrote a lot of this stuff down in what he called conferences. And one of the best ones was from Conference 10. He had someone come up and said, hey, look, there's a lot in the Bible. There's a lot of stuff that I've heard. And I just need, you got to give me something. Just give me something to grab onto, okay, that I can pray throughout my day when I'm at work. That kind of reminds me of this direction I'm trying to head in. That reminds me of what the end is. And Cassian goes, great. He said, have you ever heard of Psalm 70, right? And it's nice because so have you. We said that earlier today. Psalm 70, the beginning of Psalm 70. And I have the NIV version up here. We read ESV earlier when we were praying for Ukraine. It's, hasten, O God, to save me. Come quickly, Lord, help me. That's the NIV. I'll give you another NIV, Nate's International Version. God, I need help. Please help me. God, I need help. Please help me. And what he said is, he said, memorize this phrase. Great, you've got it memorized. God, I need help. Please help me. Turn it over in your mind. Turn it over in your mind. Think about that. Because it means really two things. It means two really profound things. Number one, it means that you believe you need help. Right? It's just an admission that I need help. And that's a really, that was maybe 2 years ago. I would have never said I need help, but I'm saying help. I need help now. Okay? The second thing it means is that it means you believe God is near enough to actually help you. Right? And that's a really profound statement of faith. If you fall into a well, you don't call someone in another country to come save you because they can't. You yell because you hope that someone can hear you, and by hearing you, they're close enough to come save you. Right? So, God, I need help. Please help me. Prayed, you know, wholeheartedly is actually a really significant statement of faith. And that's what I want to leave you with today. I want to leave you with this phrase to turn over because, God, we know what the last three pages are. We're reminded of it. That image, that woman, you know, weeping at Jesus' feet and being granted peace, that's the last. That's the last of the last bit of the story. But we have to live through this part. And so what I want to leave you with here is a phrase that I came up with. It's, I know I can't get there from here, so Lord, I need help. Please help me. And that's what I'm going to leave you with here today, church. So let's pray. God, it's difficult. It's difficult to look at this world. It's difficult to look at the ways that we hurt one another, that we've been hurt. It's difficult to understand how all of these things conspire to drive us apart. All the reasons, all the valid reasons that we have to not, you know, give each other a second chance. But God, amidst all of that, please, please, please remind us how important it is to go back to you. Remind us how important it is to go back, to go to the end. To begin with the end in mind, to know that we are going to be at your feet. That's the end for all of us. And that we're going to be granted peace in that exact moment. And to understand that makes all of these other parts a little less tense. It turns the heat down, it turns the pressure down on all of these other places in our lives. So God, as we go about our week, I pray that we can go back to you. When we find places that we know that we can't get there from here, we can say, God, I need help. Please help me. And that we can believe it. We can believe that you're close enough to help us. In your name I pray. Amen.